David Koresh spent his life with his group Rosenzweig and Diamond, and several others at the University of California at Berkeley, taking rats, dividing them into a control group and an experimental group, or in this case, two experimental groups, litter-mate brothers and sisters in each group. And one group lives in environmental deprivation with very little to see, hear, feel, taste, or smell. The other group live in exactly the same way, except in environmental enrichment, an environment full of things to see, hear, feel, taste, and smell. Then David Koresh makes his statement. It's very moving to me. It's hard to get moved about rats, but, you know, science is not always wise. Witness the atom bomb. And wisdom is not always scientific, but when you've got them both, you've got them very powerful. So David first makes a scientific statement. He says, it is clear that rats raised in environmental deprivation have small, stupid, undeveloped brains. They simply sacrifice the animal, take the brain, cut it up into sections, they weigh it, they measure it, cut it into microscopic sections, and look at it. And he says, it's clear that rats which are raised in environmental deprivation have small, stupid, undeveloped brains. And that their littermate, brothers and sisters, raised in environmental enrichment, have large, highly developed, highly intelligent brains. Then he makes a scientific statement. He says, it would be scientifically unjustifiable to assume that because this is true in rats, that it is also true in people. Then he adds Greek wisdom. He says, and it would be socially criminal to assume that it were not true in people. The last time I saw David Koresh alive, BBC had asked me to come to London to have a debate with one of our primary critics in Britain. He's an absolute meathead. And normally I don't do the debate business. Nobody really gets to say what he believes. I'm perfectly willing to go for one session where I say, well, I believe, then have somebody else come and say what he believes. And you can't win. I mean, if you do win, you turn up to be the heavyweight champion of London and environs, and I'm not the heavyweight champion of anything. I mean, I love kids. And so I don't accept those things. But this time I did, for two reasons. First of all, I love London, and they were going to pay my way. And secondly, it was a long time in the future. So I accepted. As the time got closer and closer, I got border and border and border and border, and wondering why I'd accepted this dumb invitation to have a debate. 2 weeks before it was to happen, my boredom turned to sheer terror. They called and said that he had asked for some neurological help, this guy, which well he might. So he was going to be joined by Sir John Eccles, who was a Nobel laureate in neurophysiology. And I thought, I don't understand why he wants to debate this issue. That's all we do is neurophysiology. And the other guy never heard of it. So they said, anyway, he's going to help him. And if you'd like to bring somebody with you, you can bring somebody. So I called David Koresh and said, David, how about going to London and having a debate with Sir John Eccles? And he said, it sounds like fun. And he was heading for a year at the Weizmann Institute. So he said, I'll change my schedule by a week and go with you. So he came with me. When we got there, Sir John Eccles, I think in the meantime, had read our stuff and decided he didn't want to argue about it. I was beneath him in the first place. And so he didn't show up. It was the most, I almost fell asleep on the program. It was the most boring waste of the British taxpayers' money in history. It was just ridiculous. Anyway, afterward, David and I went to a pub to have a beer because he was going on to Israel and I was coming home. And so I said, well, David, what now? I mean, you've been doing this for 30 years. And he said, very interestingly typical of him, he said, I have not spent my life trying to make more intelligent rats. He thinks rats are bright enough as it is for people's purposes. His point is he had only ever done this to prove that the brain grows by use in all creatures, including human beings. Now, David had a problem all his life. He couldn't turn his rats into people and therefore prove that what happens to people, rats also happens to people. And we've had a problem all our lives. We can't take our kids and turn them into rats and cut their brains up in little pieces. It doesn't stop anybody from demanding it. You know, when the world's being an ass, there is no end to it. There is no end to it. One time in Brazil at the University of São Paulo Medical School, I was teaching a group of neurologists, and they were all very attentive and very interested in making notes at a great rate. But there's one in every audience. You can depend on it. When I was through, and the dean was translating for me, because my Portuguese, like my French, is dreadful. And so when he was through, I asked if there were any questions. And a guy on the first row stood up, and the first thing he did was turn around and face the audience to ask me a question. That makes you suspicious. Then he asked me a 20-minute question. There aren't any 20-minute questions. There are 20-minute speeches, but there are no 20-minute questions. And as he went on and on around the audience, people began to mutter their names. They're saying, "Stupido, stupido." Well, even I could translate "stupido." And when he was through, the dean said, "Forget it." And I said, "No, please, sir, what'd he say?" And he said, "Well," he said, "if you take a severely brain injured kid and fix him, how do you know he's fixed?" And I said, well, let me answer. If the other kids can't tell him from them, and his parents can't tell him from the other kids, and if his teacher can't, and if his doctor can't, and if we can't, we think he's fixed. And around the audience, people smiled. But there is no end to it. When the world's big an ass, there's no end to it. This guy jumped up again, turned around, faced the audience again, and made another 20-minute speech. And when he was through, the dean said, "Please, just forget it." And I said, "No, dean, tell me what he said." And he said, "Well, if you insist." He said, "Have you ever fixed a brain-injured child and then examined his brain to see what had happened?" And I said, "Dean, if I may answer him in the same spirit in which he asked the question." And the dean said, "Be my guest." So I said, "Well, in Philadelphia, where I come from, parents are a strange group, and they have certain tribal taboos and customs, and if you fix a kid, they don't want you to cut his head open and look at his brain, and I notice that's a custom here in Brazil, and even here in São Paulo, but obviously not a custom with this man, so since we can do it with all children, perhaps we could take his children and do that and then cut their heads open." When the world's being an ass, there is no end to it, no end to it. And the demands are, first of all, they're not only immoral, they're illegal in many cases, such as this. So David had his problem. He couldn't turn his rats into people, and we have our problem. We can't turn our people into rats. But there is a time when evidence, when it piles up to mountain high, however empirical, it becomes more criminal not to act on it than it is to act prematurely on it. And a friend of mine, a neurosurgeon, says of himself, he says, "I am known as a radical surgeon, and perhaps I am, but I know of no more radical act than watching a child die, knowing he's going to die and doing nothing about it. Sometimes to do nothing is much more radical than to do something. To live in a world where children, where illiteracy is growing, a return to the dark ages, and do nothing about it except throw more money at it and make the problem worse. We have spent increasingly gigantic sums of money in education while the results have gone down. The reason is, when I was a child, it was the responsibility of the home to teach a child to talk. And it was also a responsibility to teach a child to read. And every kid I knew in my middle-class neighborhood learned to read the way I learned to read. I sat on my mother's lap and she read books to me. And when she got tired and started to skip a page, I'd say, "No, Mom, you skipped a page." And when she missed a word because you're getting sleepy, I'd say, "No, Mom, it doesn't say that. It says this." All kids did. And kids were really expected to go to school reading. It wasn't a requirement. It was the way things were. If we insist in sending two-month-olds to daycare, it is dreadful to build houses on sand and watch them collapse while we continue to build houses on sand. It's a dreadful, dreadful thing. And the downgrading of mothers, the downgrading of motherhood, is the dumbest thing we have ever done in history. There's a lady who I never met in my life whose name is Nancy Todd Cohen. And when Newsweek, I'd like to meet her, when Newsweek wrote an article, the lead story, was called "What Price Day School?" and talked about day school. And Nancy Todd Cohen wrote a letter, which I read, which is the closest to Nancy Todd Cohen I've ever gotten. She said, "You asked the question, what price day school? And I would like to answer it. $14,000 a year. She said, when my baby was born, I was working and making $14,000 a year, and I was turning my baby over to a stranger to grow my baby when I realized the ludicrousness of this. And so I stopped my job, and it is not enough to talk of quality time. She said, we must also talk of quantity time, and it is not enough. So she said, so now we don't have a second car, and we're back to having financial problems again, but I'm teaching my baby, and what it costs is $14,000 a year. That's the price of day school. She's a brilliant gal, Mom. I'd like to meet her sometime.
I'd like to ask you what you think is the influence of television. You had said earlier that you don't have television at the Institute.
Yeah, we do. It just happens. This little boy doesn't have television. You know, it's a sin. It really is a sin. It's a sin. The sin is that fantastic electronic capacity. It's miraculous, that capacity. And the awfulness of what we have done with it appalls me. It could be such a power in the world. You know, when the cover of Time magazine said, "Who shot JR?" I sent a telegram to the editor. And I said, does it really matter who shot JR? As long as somebody did. And I'm getting, if there are any worse human beings in the world than the people on those nutty things, I don't know who they are. I'm getting up a hit fund to get the rest of the cast. And if you'd like to contribute to it, we'll see if we get a hit man to kill them all, not just shoot them. You know, I thought my telegram was kind of funny. Doesn't matter who shot JR as long as somebody. Do you know, I got a serious answer back from the editor saying not all people like all television shows, and we're sorry you don't like whatever that program's called. Indeed, it was television that broke the code. Remember I was talking about how you understand a word through the ear, and I said there are three requirements. The stimulus must be loud, clear, and repeated. The auditory pathway grows by use. It grows by the passage of methods across it, of messages across it. Now, how do we learn visual language? Well, English is also not an ideographic language, and these don't look like glasses. So how do we learn that? Well, that's a convention too, just like the noise. I mean, if we had agreed to call these og and spell it zzz, then any time you wrote zzz on the blackboard, I would say og and think of these. I mean, it's a convention that the French have decided on different grunts, and the Spanish and the Japanese on another series of grunts and another series of pictures. Well, what are the requirements to learn to read? The visual message, glasses, on the blackboard falls in the eye. The eye sees but does not understand. The eye is a piece of meat. It's a tube in the brain. In the brain, the message is broken down into electrochemical impulses and flashed to a brain that lives in a blind world. The brain understands but does not see. It gets electrochemical impulses representing the idea classes. Well, if that's true, why don't all children learn to read spontaneously the way they all learn to hear spontaneously? There's the answer. Visually, there are three requirements. The message must be large, clear, and repeated. And this we have failed to do. The message is simply too small. In order to make books and newspapers transportable, so you don't need a wheelbarrow, we have made the print very small. And it is simply too small for the immature visual pathway. That's the way the pathway matures, by reading. But the message is too small for the immature pathway. Thus, we have kept written language a secret from children for 10,000 years. And then along comes television. And the guy gets on and screams, Coca-Cola, 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 loud, loud, loud. And there's the message, large, clear, and repeated. And the kids ride down the road and say, it's Coca-Cola, that's stop, that's this, that. That's how I broke the code. There were two things that made us understand. I feel idiotic that it took so long to understand. I'm only pleased that by the time the message was beat into me, the truth was beat into me, I was prepared to understand it. Two things happened to me. One day I was riding down a road with my little nephew, and we passed a billboard that said Coca-Cola, long time ago. And he said, Coca-Cola. So I went to the chief of psychological service, and I said, you know, Carl, kids are reading. And I told him about my nephew. And he said, no, it's not reading. It is pattern recognition. He recognized the pattern, Coca-Cola. And I said, well, I don't see how that negates it. So the next time I went out of my way to ride down the road, and again, my little nephew said, Coca-Cola. And I said, what do you mean, Coca-Cola? He said, Coca-Cola, you know, Coca-Cola. What you drink? Well, that's what I understand, what I see. And Carl said, oh, but it's the color, the red and the white. Back in those days, we only had black and white television. And so that disturbed me. I thought he was reading. And Carl said, no, he recognized the pattern. And I said, gee, Carl, I think that's what I do. I think in all the words where I recognize the pattern, I can read, and all the words that I don't recognize the pattern, I can't read. I don't recognize that French pattern most of the time. And really, you know, it's easier to read than it is to hear through your ear. For instance, I'm a boob in French, as I told you. But I can read a French newspaper, though, because it's easier. The newspaper doesn't have the accent. It doesn't. I'll tell you what I can say in 93 languages. Please speak more slowly. You know, parlez lentement. Voilà de vigar. It's much easier to read a language than it is to hear it through your now. Not Japanese, because we're not familiar with the alphabet. But I can read an Italian newspaper within reason. I can read a French newspaper within reason. I can read a Brazilian Portuguese newspaper within reason. I don't get the niceties, but I get the message of what's going on. It's easier. We have kept written language a secret from children for 10,000 years. And then the blabbermouths come on television and start screaming and putting it up in big letters, and the kids have broken the code. So the question is not whether it's good or not. The truth is, kids are reading. Now, if the question is whether it's good, then we better take down all billboards. We better hide all newspaper headlines. The fact is, they've broken the code. If you wanted to teach all the kids to read, including the children of the illiterates, this is my program, by the way, for the inner city. We both out, are we? Well, it's much easier to teach a 5-year-old than a 6. It's easier to teach a 4 than a 5. It's easier to teach a 3 than a 4. It's easier to teach a 2 than a 3. What's arriving in the brain in both cases is the idea glasses. That's what's arriving. Not a visual picture, an auditory picture, but electrochemical impulses representing the idea glasses. The children have, in fact, broken the code by the... You watch children, for instance, watching Happy the Clown. They wander away. They come back. They wander away. But when the commercial comes on, every kid dashes to the television set because it's loud and clear and repeated in a big message. It's the commercials they love because they learn from them. They'd rather learn what's got hexachlorophene in it then look at Happy the Clown. That's the truth of the matter. They'd rather learn than eat. You know, little kids are so dumb. They think they're in training to be grown-ups. They don't think they're in training to be 3-year-olds. They think they're in training to be grown-ups. If you gave every kid in the world his choice between a corral full of ponies or a room full of chocolate and nut sundaes or one grown-up who would pay attention to him, mind you, every kid alive would pick the one grown-up who'd pay attention to him. First choice, mommy. Second choice, daddy. Third choice, anybody who'd pay attention to him. They think they're in training to be grown-ups. They think learning is the best thing that ever happened. Nature built them that way for survival purposes, to learn not to get run over by a car if you're a little squirrel. But you got to learn it first. And sometimes they don't survive long enough to learn it. Little creatures, mostly we protect the kids, and they do survive, but we've also protected them from learning.
So do you think that the impact of television has been such that the visual image has been made much more important?
Yes. So, for instance, Neil Harvey, who is the dean of the Temple Fay Institute at the Institutes, which is the academic institute, which is responsible for the learning of everybody from little kids to postgraduates who come to learn about what we're doing at the institutes. And His PhD dissertation was a fascinating one. It was called Wordland Workshop. They took a group of volunteer parents in Philadelphia, and they sent a group of educators out to evaluate the three-year-olds. I think they were all three-year-olds, as I remember. And then they took a group in Binghamton, New York, and did the same thing. And then they presented to the kids in Binghamton, New York, Happy the Clown, or something like that, you know. And the kids in Philadelphia, they presented Woodland Wordland Workshop, in which they had a kids program, but it was all full of words. And this went on for, I think, a year. Then they went back and evaluated all the children. 30% of the kids in the Philadelphia group, and by the way, it was on at 6 o'clock in the morning, which ain't the best time in the world for parents and kids to get together. 30% of the kids in Philadelphia, I forget the exact number, 28.2 or something, had learned to read the words that had been presented to them. In the group in Binghamton, who had no words in their Happy the Clown program, one kid had learned to read. It turned out that his mother had bought How to Teach Your Baby to Read because it was a blind study. The parents didn't know. They just knew that something good was going to happen. And that's his doctoral dissertation is on that subject. So now the question comes, is it good or not? First of all, the real question is it good to read? If it's true that Chinese children can read, then the question, is it good or bad for them to read? The question seems to me almost the ultimate absurdity. With 30% of kids in school failing to learn to read, and by the way, their lives will be changed, and for the worst, there ain't any question about it. You know, having lived with people all over the world, from prehistoric, pre-Stone Age, not Stone Age people, people who aren't up to the Stone Age yet, in the Xingu in Brazil, and watch babies born and grow. One thing I've noticed about everybody in the world is that nobody starves gracefully. When people are starving, they insist on kicking up a fuss about it. And in Philadelphia, there's a judge, an extraordinary judge, named Juanita Kidd Stout. First of all, she's a gal. And secondly, she's black. And if you're going to be black and a gal and a judge, you've got to be very bright in Philadelphia, PA, and most places in the world. And she's very bright. She specializes in juveniles, and she says an interesting thing. She says, the juveniles who appear before me have almost nothing in common. They're tall and short, fat and thin. They're poor and they're rich. Most of them are poor, but some of them are rich. They really don't have two things in common. First of all, they're in trouble. That's why they're standing before me. And secondly, they can't read, and that's why they're in trouble. Jails are full of people who are in jail because they can't read. Now, there isn't a crime called not reading. There's a crime called not working. If you're born in the inner city in Philadelphia and nobody around you can read, there's a very large chance that you're not going to be able to read. And if so, you can't get a job. You can't be a janitor. I mean, if first of all, if you apply for a job, you better not tell the boss you can't read or you won't get the job. And so you don't tell him. And then the first night he leaves you a message saying, be sure to clean the basement windows, and you can't read. And you don't clean the basement windows, the next day you're fired. And since nobody starves gracefully, sooner or later you pick up a club. And then you end standing in front of Juanita Kidd Stout. The interesting things about it, the institutes are in a place called Chestnut Hill, which is a very wealthy suburb. We're the only people who don't belong there. And it's an Ivy League neighborhood, old wealth. You know, family's been rich for generations, mostly a Princeton neighborhood. So almost everybody's a Princeton graduate. Now, if you live in Chestnut Hill and all your friends are Princeton graduates and you can't read, there are many ways of dying besides starving. You can die emotionally, too. And if everybody's a Princeton graduate, the kids you grew up with, and you can't read, you're not a Princeton graduate or even a high school graduate. Well, you could be a high school graduate, come to think of it. You die, too. And in the end, you pick up a club, one kind or another, and you end up standing in front of Juanita Kidd Stout. You're there because you can't read. Now, if we wanted to use television to change that, one of the... When we did the math book, Simon & Schuster published it, and so I got to meet all the big wheels for a conference, you know, a pre-publication conference, and one of the guys said to me, "What about the mothers in Harlem who can't read? What about them?" And I said, "Well, first of all, do they buy many Simon & Schuster books, the mothers in Harlem who can't read, from a sales standpoint, which is what you're worried about?" And he said, "Well, what about them?" "Well, first of all, let's suppose there were nothing you could do. Suppose you could do nothing about them. Would that be a good reason to not teach everybody else to read because you couldn't do anything about them? Would it be better if we were all illiterate? Now, secondly, suppose you really wanted to do something about it. Suppose that. I want Bailey to do something about it. I tell you what I'd do. I'd go to the billboard company. People put up the billboard and say, I want three of your billboards for 6 months in the inner city. And then I'd go to the newspapers and say, we're going to have the word of the week. And I want you to print it up in the masthead, red letters. And then I'd go to Tasty Cake Company and say, Tasty Cake, you know those things at the bottom of the Tasty Cakes, that cardboard, I'd like you to print on it the word of the week. And then I would go to the television people and the radio people and say, let's all talk about the word of the week. And the word this week is mommy. And the billboard says mommy. And the television says mommy. And the radio talks about the signs that say mommy. And the Tasty Cakes have mommy in the bottom of them. And you know, we'd not only teach the kids to read, we'd also teach their illiterate parents to read. See, all they have to do is break the code. All you have to do is break the code. All you have to do is to know that this means this. Take math. You know, we teach kids math by teaching them reality, by teaching them not numerals, but numbers. Cards with red dots on them. Have you ever seen them? So mother says, this is one, holding up one red dot on a white card. This is two. This is 98. This is 100. And the kids can read them. The kids, mothers say, what is this plus this? Some of them can't talk yet. Is it this or this? And show them again dots. See, that's reality. Numbers are reality. Numerals are symbols that represent. See, if I write on the blackboard, Kathy Sokol, and say, what's this? I do this from the families, this class. Pick one of the students, write their name in the blackboard and say, what's that? And class says, that's Kathy Sokol. And I say, no. That's a chalk mark on the board, which is a symbol for it. There's Kathy Sokol. She cries and she exults and she worries and she's happy. And that's Kathy Sokol. This is a symbol. And everybody said, well, of course, I mean, if that's what you mean. See, in language, nobody ever mixes a symbol up with reality. In arithmetic, everybody thinks E-I-G-H-T is 8 or two circles on top of each other, as the Romans would have it, V-1-1-1. They are not. They are to 8 what C-A-T-H-Y is to you. They're symbols that represent you. In language, obviously, we know that, but in mathematics, we don't, because we don't know the reality. So we teach kids reality. This is what these dots say. Well, and they learn. Now, adults watching that happen simply are not prepared to believe that a kid can recognize 98 dots placed at random on a card from 99 dots placed on a card. They can't believe it. The only thing is the kids all do it. See, we are enumerate. Now, if you take somebody who's illiterate and hold up a sign that says Kathy Sokol, and say this says Kathy Sokol, see, they have a right to say, and they do say to themselves, you mean that there are 500,000 of those squiggles, and you can tell them from each other? I mean, you know, that's impossible. How could you tell 500,000 squiggles made up of other squiggles from each other? See, it is impossible for somebody who's literate to imagine the position that an illiterate is in. It is impossible for somebody enumerate to appreciate the position that a numerate is in. The kids are numerate and we're innumerate. Now, if you want that borne home on you, all you have to do is send me to Japan, where suddenly I am an absolute, total illiterate. I have to have a message from the hotel telling the taxi driver where to take me in case he doesn't know English, and a message to get back to the hotel. I don't know what subway to get on. I am illiterate. I don't recognize. And it's fair to me to say, you mean you can tell all those squiggles from each other? See, because in Japan, I'm illiterate. Well, we grown-ups are innumerate, and the kids are numerate. And the kids don't understand how we can't do it, as Japanese don't understand how I can't read Japanese, you know, in the large sense. You see what I'm saying? Well, the children are now, if we set up that campaign, and, you know, it wouldn't cost anybody anything, and the billboard company could write it off their income tax, and the newspaper could write off more than the ink costs them on the top of the paper, and the TV station have something sensible to talk about instead of all the tragedies that beset us. You know, it's a wonder if everybody doesn't commit suicide. The front page of every newspaper in the world is a story of murder, vice, hatred, insanity, corruption, dishonesty, and so is the television station full of all that. And, you know, there's another world. There's a world of sane people. One of my ambitions in life is to someday get up and read on the front page of the New York Times that Mr. John Jones of 29 Maplewood Avenue got up this morning and had a pleasant breakfast with his family, and then he drove to work, and he didn't hit anybody or cut in front of anybody, and he did an honest day's work, and he consoled one fellow employee who was having a bad time, and then he got in his car and drove home and again didn't kill anybody and had dinner and watched telly for a little while with the family and went to bed. Because that's what happened to 99% of all the people in the world today. But one would not think that with all the other side of the story. It would be nice if everybody came to the Institute and saw a lot of young people, Japanese, American staff members who work 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, who get paid less on an hourly basis than the kitchen staff in money. And you can't get rid of them with wild horses. They're doing something that matters, and they know that it matters. And they're there every day. And they're real, too. Like everybody on drugs is real, they're real, too. And maybe somebody should tell about them as opposed to the maniacal things that go on all day long. And you know, if we just did that. Problem is, everybody says, gee, that's interesting, and nobody does anything about it. And unhappily, we are all involved 24 hours a day in fixing kids and don't have time to go out and propagate such things. I would love to have an appointment with Bennett. I'd love to spend an hour with William Bennett. I'd love to spend an hour with the Surgeon General and say, how'd you like to do things successfully at 1/80th the price? Because this is what we can do. I think they're both honest people. I think Koop's an honest people. He's to the right of Kublai Khan politically, but I think he's an honest man who would really like to do better things for the health of the world. And the world really is nutty as a fruitcake. It bothers me that it is. You know, 1984 is upon us and gone. The health department's in charge of illness, and the mental health department's in charge of insanity, and the peace department's in charge of war, and you know, it sort of bugs me. And by the way, words like hope are now evil words. We're accused, for instance, of giving people false hope. One time in Ireland, I was interviewed by an Irish guy on Irish radio. His name was Mr. O'Shannon. Mr. O'Shannon was very tall and very handsome with a beautiful, educated Irish voice. And inside his head, there was a potato where his brain should have been. And so we had an interview on Irish radio for 2 hours. And he said to me, "No, Dr. Doman, what about false hope?" In this beautiful, booming Irish voice. And, you know, it's a question I've been asked 10,000 times. And I said, "What about it, Mr. O'Shannon?" Well, he was terrified, and if people didn't ask him questions, he asked questions. And I said, "Well, what about it?" And there was a long pause, and you could see the potato whirring around his head. And he said, "Well, let me put it differently. What about false hope?" And I said, "Well, what about it, Mr. O'Shannon?" And he said, "Well, no, you must answer the question." And I said, "Well, if you'll ask me a question, I'll try to answer it. What is the question? What do I think about false hope? I think it's a contradiction in terms. I mean, hope, how can you have false hope? I mean, may I not hope for it? It's sort of like a prayer. I mean, can't I hope for anything I want? Can't I pray for anything I want? And he said, well, oh, that's not the question. You're evading the question. Do all of the children get well? And I said, oh, good Lord, no. We're not nearly that bright yet, Mr. O'Shannon. And he said, well, then, didn't the families have... Oh, aren't the families upset if the kid doesn't get well? And I said, they're devastated, and so am I, Mr. O'Shannon. Now what's the question? It wasn't the hope that was false. I mean, didn't they... Would you rather them have despair? See, it's false despair that is the problem, not false hope. It's false despair. Parents being told by the millions that there is no hope for their child, you see... That's false despair. Anyway, he said, I said, of course, we're devastated. And he said, well, that wasn't false hope. And I said, golly, no, the hope was a proper hope. It was a fine hope. And he said, well, then you shouldn't have taken those children. And I said, well, if you'll tell me in advance who's going to win, who's going to lose, Mr. O'Shannon, which I'm not smart enough to know, then we won't take the ones who are going to lose. We'll just take the ones who are going to win. And he said, well, you're evading the question. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm dealing with the question, Mr. O'Shannon. So he said, I'm only burdening you with this because it's a very common thing for people to say about the work with brain-injured children. So I said, Mr. O'Shannon, let me ask a question. You're proposing that for the people who don't win that they shouldn't have started, since we don't know who they are, would you deny the people who won the chance to win? Maybe we shouldn't take anybody, Mr. O'Shannon, then nobody'd have false hope. He didn't understand that at all. I mean, he didn't really understand much of anything. Anyway, I said, Mr. O'Shannon, let me ask a question. Are you married? Well, he thought that was a real trick question. And he finally admitted he was. And so I said, do you love your life? That was even trickier. And he thought it would be politic to say yes. I don't know whether he does or not, but he decided it'd be wise to say yes. So he said yes. So I said, now, Mr. O'Shannon, your wife might get appendicitis. We all might. Let's suppose she did. You know, there are some people who during appendectomy die. Not very many, but some. I have a very dear friend who died at 26 in an appendectomy being operated by his uncle, who was the best surgeon in Mexico, and he died. I didn't say that to him. But I said, now then, Mr. O'Shannon, if your wife had appendicitis and she had an appendectomy and she died, wouldn't you be disappointed? And he said, well, of course. Well, of course. And I said, well, now you could protect yourself against that. If you didn't have the appendectomy, you wouldn't have had any false hope. She would have died, surely, but you wouldn't have been upset. You would have... And he said, no, really, this is all very evasive of the question. I said, Mr. O'Shannon, it is the question that you're asking me. I've just put it in different terms at the question. You know, this went on for 2 hours. For the first one-third, I was annoyed. All the questions had been supplied in by the Spastic Society. And then the next third, I kind of had fun. And the last third, I thought, I'm going to make this jughead understand if it takes 6 weeks. So now he was trapped and upset. And then he remembered his questions. And he said, now, Dr. Doman, tell me, when do you give up? Everybody proposes this as if it were a virtue. When do you give up, Dr. Doman? And I said, on Thursdays, Mr. O'Shannon. Anybody who's not well by Thursday, out. So he thought about that for a long time, and he said that couldn't be true. And he said, no, this is a serious matter. And I said, I think it is too, Mr. O'Shannon. And he said, no, you don't really give up on Thursdays. And I said, no, we don't, Mr. O'Shannon. He said, when do you give up? And I said, in May, every May, anybody who isn't well, we stop. And he thought about it. He thought maybe that was true. And he thought about that for a while. And he decided maybe it wasn't true. Suppose you start in April. So he said, no, this is a very serious matter, Dr. Doman. When do you give up? See, professionals come and sit in the back row. And that's one of their questions. When do you give up? As if it were a virtue to give up. Do you know what it means? It means they think we're trying to keep everybody on the program as long as possible, to get as much money as possible. Of course, we lose $1,000 a year a kid. That would be a brilliant move on our part to see how long we can keep you there, so it costs an extra $1,000 a year. See, it doesn't tell you anything about us, what's in our mind, but it tells you a great deal about what's in their mind when they ask the question, huh? So Mr. O'Shannon said, I'll just polish off, Mr. if I may, because he's a microcosm of the world, too. He said, well, no, it's very serious. When do you give up? And I said, Mr. O'Shannon, when do you think we should give up? When would be a good time to give up? I said, you know, we're sitting here, and by the way, this is in the post office on O'Connell Street in Ireland. And I said, Mr. O'Shannon, we're sitting here in the post office. Out there is the Irish Sea. And I would guess that once in a while some Irish kid falls in the Irish Sea. And I would guess if some Irishman saw him, he'd jump in and try to save him. Now, when would you give him a medal for giving up, Mr. O'Shannon, when he was 100 yards from the child, or when he was 10 yards from the child, or 5? When would be a good time for him to give up? And then Mr. O'Shannon decided he had me. And he said, well, suppose the tide were going out, that they might both be drowned. And I said, that's true, Mr. O'Shannon, they might. Now, suppose the next week another Irish kid fell in the Irish Sea. I guess it would be a good idea for no Irishman to jump in and try to save them, because they both might drown. And he said, well, now we really must get back to the question. And I said, Mr. O'Shannon, we're talking about the question. When is it good to give up? When would you like us to give up? And by the way, talking to the families, these are all new families of brain injured kids, I stop and say, now, tell me, when do you hope we'll give up on your child? When will you think it's a virtue if we give up? When are you going to give up? And everybody says, never. And that's right. The answer is never. Anyway, so now I had gone through the being amused and having fun with Mr. O'Shannon, and now I made up my mind I was going to make him understand if it took forever. So I said, Mr. O'Shannon, we are in the post office in O'Connell Street. This is where the Irish martyrs died in 1916, isn't it? In this building. And he said, yes, yes, it is. I said, this is a sacred place in Ireland. It is the most sacred place in Ireland. It's where the Irish martyrs died in 1916. And he said, yes. And I said, Mr. O'Shannon, it's now 1976. And I read in the paper this morning that 3 people died in Belfast. When are you going to give up, Mr. O'Shannon? When are you going to give up? And he said, I take your point. That's it.
Have you ever been accused of trying to manipulate the natural evolutionary process with these well children, that there's a certain standard?
I guess that. I guess in the broad sense, yes. In the specific, no, in the broad sense, yes. The truth is, what we're doing is trying to give the children the opportunity that nature intended. And it's, that's what happened to Leonardo. He got out of the lockstep. Do you know who John Ciardi was? The poet John Ciardi. He just died. He's brilliant. God, he's brilliant. He's wonderful. And he just died. The month that How to Teach Your Baby to Read was published, John Ciardi did a 1-page article in the Saturday Review, which infuriated me because he said in 1 page what my book said. That's an annoying characteristic of poets. And he wrote a page called When Do They Know Too Much? And he said it beautifully. I'm sorry, I can't do it as well as he did. He said, a friend of mine in the happy pursuit of raising his 3-year-old daughter taught her how to read. And later, when he sent her to school, he was called in and reprimanded for having over-accelerated her. And that was in quotes. And he said, and admonished for having done so. He said, now to keep the record straight, I've spent my life teaching, and I have taught many, many teachers, and I have found many of them to be so under-accelerated that it appalls me. And he said, now, before somebody accuses me of attacking the temple of education, You need not tell me that a good teacher, the good teacher, is overworked and underpaid. You needn't tell me that. I know that. And he said, I have in my litter one happy slowpoke, the oaf of my litter. And it is exactly my fear for him that he will fall into the lockstep methods of education. Are they back? Oh, Christ. He said, it is exactly my fear for them that they'll fall into the lockstep pace of their mindless peers. And he said, if I ever catch him being over accelerated, I intend to shower him with gifts. I intend to bribe his way to suspicion. And he said, if my friend committed a sin against the norm by teaching his baby to read, then he must now pay the expiation of finding that special teacher.
Okay, let's just...
I didn't really answer the question you just asked me, did I? Are we accused of doing that? Yes, I suppose we are. My answer would be, we are giving the child to be the opportunity to be what nature intended him to be. That we're aiding nature instead of subverting it.
What do you consider to be the optimal state of human beingness?
Yeah, if I can paraphrase the question to say, what would be my definition of genius? Would that answer the question, sort of?
Okay.
I think that the genius of the world are the people who see the difference between the way things are and the way they ought to be. Everybody sees the difference between the way things are and the way they ought to be. The geniuses are the ones that pick the things that matter and then spend their lives moving them closer to the way they ought to be. And so I think the ultimate state of humanity should be a world in which we see the difference between the way things are and the way they ought to be, and then move them closer to the way they ought to be. That's what Jonas Salk did. He was driven crazy by the idea that a bunch of children who had never hurt anybody were paralyzed and died, and he did something about it. He moved it closer to the way it ought to be, and there aren't any more of those children in the places where people have the vaccine. And so he meets my definition of genius. Has nothing to do with numbers. I suspect he'd come out very well in an IQ test, that most brilliant people score well, and most less bright people don't score as well. But it isn't the test of intelligence. The test of intelligence is what you do.
Hmm. So do you feel that each and every individual has immense potential that has not even begun to be tapped?
There is not the slightest question in my mind that's true, and I have tons of evidence to support such a view, and I have no question. I do not think we will ever reach our potential. The brain will simply keep growing beyond. That's what it's always done, from Australopithecus, who had a tiny little brain, to us. And see, Leonardo, sometimes people quote me saying, Glenn Doman says we don't use one-tenth of our brains. My grandmother said that to me when I was a little boy. Most everybody's grandmother said it to them. We don't use 1/1000th of our brain. Perhaps Leonardo came closer than anybody else did. He was a genius in every way. So I think that we're not even close, and that we'll never get close. But I'd sure like to use more of it than we do. We'd have a saner world. No, not long ago I got a letter which was addressed to Glenn Doman, Fort Sanity, Pennsylvania, and it arrived. That just delighted me. That pleased me.
So, in effect, what you are doing is creating a new species.
I think not. I think that we are making people a little closer to the way they were intended to be. Yes, I think we're moving them a little closer to the way they were intended to be. The kids will grow up and they'll carry on. If intelligence is not a good thing, then we ought to make ourselves as stupid as possible. And if knowledge is not a good thing, we should make ourselves as ignorant as possible. And if mothers loving children and children loving mothers and fathers is not a good thing, Well, I mean, it's so absurd that, you know, I really don't understand the counter discussion. See, what it really centers about is everybody's fear of intelligence, and we shouldn't be afraid of intelligence. It's what we people have that the other creatures don't have. You know, the idea that I'm chained to being what my grandmother was is nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. The grandmother that I remember was a Pennsylvania Dutch farm lady. The others were dead, and so I didn't know them very well. But that grandmother, she was a lovely woman. She was a God-fearing, straightforward, hardworking person. And the person who would be most offended by the idea that I was chained to being what my grandmother was would be my grandmother. She spent her life arranging for her kids to start where she ended. She spent her life arranging for her children to stand on her shoulders. And then my parents spent their lives arranging for me to stand on their shoulders. And then I've spent some part of my life arranging for my kids to stand on my shoulders, and they're in the process of arranging for my grandchildren to stand on their shoulders. That's the difference between human beings and all the other creatures. The chimpanzees are doomed to live it out all over again. With what may be added by the occasional stranger that wanders into the tribe and survives. What made the difference with human beings was when we learned to write and read. Because then I was no longer stuck with what my father knew. He was glad to tell me all he knew, and he did. But when I learned to read, I could pop down and talk to old Will Shakespeare anytime I wanted. And by the way, he couldn't go away to wash the dishes or have to go to work, and I could sit and talk it over with him as long as I wanted. You know, what a shame for we parents. We go through all the crises. We live with the dirty diapers and running noses and the dash to the hospital at 2 o'clock in the morning and the stark terror when we lose sight of them on the beach for 10 seconds. And then it comes time to introduce them to everything that's beautiful in the English language and all the beautiful art in the world, and we turn them over to a bunch of strangers called teachers. What a shame for us. What a shame for us. What a sadness for us. We can start in day one doing it ourselves, and mothers have been doing their best to do that since time began. They're the best teachers the world has ever seen. They're the best teachers the world will ever see, and it seems to me it's the men who got the bad side of the deal. It seemed to me that mom, by nature, had to stay home and take care of the child. She was the one who had breasts, and so she had to stay. And the old boy had to go out and slay the deer out into a more dangerous world. Now, if that makes me sound as if I'm a macho male pig, I hope it doesn't, because I'm not. The first time anybody ever asked me that question, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation came down with a television crew a long time ago. And they said to me, "What do you think about women's lib?" And I said, "Well, I really haven't thought about it very much, but I can tell you what my wife says. My wife says that she has always felt superior to men, and she sees no reason to accept equality at this stage of the game." And see, instead of making women into fake men, we ought to be making men into imitation women. We'd have a saner world if we did that. It would be hard to imagine a world. You know, I was a soldier, and I was proud. I was proud to be a soldier. And my war was a war that needed to be fought because there wasn't any other alternative. And you know, when women first became soldiers, being a proud soldier, it seemed strange to me, but golly, they looked as neat as anybody else did in their uniforms, and I had to admit that. And then they marched, and I watched them march, and they marched as well as anybody else. And then I saw them doing dirty fighting, and they seemed to do that as well as anybody else. And then the ultimate picture appeared in my mind. I could see an 18-year-old young woman, infantry woman, plunging a bayonet into the breast of another 18-year-old infantry woman. And it seemed to me the end absurdity, the ultimate absurdity. And then it occurred to me, of course, that a young man plunging a bayonet in the breast of another young man was equally absurd. And it just brings the whole thing round. And so I think it would be a good idea if all men were trying to be imitation women instead of all women trying to be imitation men. I mean, Women are women and men are men, and we're different from each other. And by the way, my own mother, was a great gal. She was a wonderful, hardworking gal, and she raised three kids, and she raised her husband simultaneously, and she did a good job of it. And when we were grown enough, my mother went out and got a job, and she kept the job until she retired from the job, and then she told the only lie she ever told in her life. She lied about her age and got another job. And when mother was 85, she was working, petrified that her boss would find out she was actually she wasn't actually 70, as she had told him. He was petrified she'd quit, by the way. And one day I went to pick her up at work when she was 85, and we walked to the car. And I said, "Mother, I am surprised how short you've gotten recent times. I'd always thought of my mother as being a very tall woman." And I said, "Mother, how tall were you at your tallest?" And she said, "Almost 5 feet." I had always thought she was tall. If I hadn't asked her that, and you said to me, "What was your mother like?" I would say she was a rather tall woman. She would never got to be 5 feet. In my eyes, she was a very tall woman. And so she raised her family. She taught us all to read before we went to school. She thought that was part of her job. And then she went out and did what she did. She enjoyed very much working, and she did a great job of it. You know, we're the only creatures that do what we do. Other creatures stay with the young every second until the young are able to fly, the birds, and then they throw them out of the nest, and then they go on with their lives. Kids are done essentially by the time they're six. They are who they're going to be. And if we have made them humane and decent and bright and knowledgeable, they'll grow into knowledgeable, bright, humane grown-ups. And we can do that by the time they're six. And it would suit me if I had to do it over again, if I got to stay home with the kids until they were six. You don't have to tell me about drudgery and dirty things. I know about all that. Anybody's right mind knows all about that. And so
if I were to distill your philosophy, it seems basically that the children should be with their parents.
Oh, yes, I certainly think so. I wish there was some way to arrange for both parents to be with them. Yes, I'd like that. And I'd like all parents to know. You know, every mother looks at her new baby, and she looks in his eyes, and she says, "My God, he's a genius." But everybody tells her it's not true. And so she says, "Well, secretly, I know that he is." And you know, she's right. She's looking at potential genius with all of the babies. And they shouldn't be talked out. I'm petrified that we are going to bully mothers out of their natural instincts. I tell our mothers, when you've heard all this, if it seems natural and comfortable to you, you ought to do it. And if it doesn't, you should run, not walk, to the nearest exit. Don't let anybody in the world bully you into... Let's take discipline. Let's take that. Mother reads an article by a PhD in Reader's Digest, mostly a bachelor, who says, "Spare the rod and spoil the child. You ought to beat them every Thursday, whether they need it or not." And mother says, "Gee, that doesn't sound right to me, but I'm only a mother, and he's a PhD. Then she reads another one by another PhD who says, "Never put a finger on your child, or he'll grow up to hate your gaudy guts and you'll ruin his little ego." And mother says, "You know, that doesn't sound right either, but I'm only a mother. Here are two PhDs giving me conflicting advice." I have a strong suspicion if all mothers could forget everything that all professionals ever said to them, including me, and if every time she thinks maybe she ought to hang one in the seat of his pants, she did so regardless of what anybody said, and every time she thinks she ought to pick him up in her arms and love him, regardless of what anybody says, that if she did that, she'd be right 99% of the time. And I don't know any professional who's right about anything 99% of the time. And I'm scared to death we're going to bully mothers out of their instinctual behavior toward children. It's been a good behavior that got us from the caves to here. And so I'm for mothers being more mothers, not less mothers. I am not for turning our 1-month olds over to daycare centers. I know that there are mothers who have to work because they have no choice, so that they can either work or starve. I know that. And I'm in great sympathy with that, and I think we should do something about it. What I think we should do about it, for instance, I think it'd be a great idea if the government went out of the education business and turned it over to schools. And then parents could pick the exact school they wanted. And by the way, the billions of dollars of money we'd save would provide a rich education for everybody. We'd give certificates to all the poor people. And then if you wanted your kid to go to a school where there are only white Anglo-Saxons and where they read the Bible or didn't read the Bible, you could send them to one. If you wanted your kid to go to school where there were as many kinds of people there as possible and you always read the Bible or never read the Bible or whatever, everybody could send their kid to the school they wanted. And if the school didn't measure up, they'd take them out and stop paying. And we'd start having elegant schools. And when education began, there was no other possibility except the government doing it. You know, when everybody had the privilege of being educated, there was no other way. But now it ought to get out of the education business and give certificates to all the poor people. Our taxes go way down. We could send our kids to elegant schools. You know, it is unbelievable what it costs to educate a kid more commonly, not to educate him under the present system. And that's what I really think ought to happen. And then we could stop all the quarrels about whether we should bus them or not bus them. You could send your kid to whatever. You could reinforce all your own biases by doing whatever you chose. Because in the end, that's what we're going to do anyway. We're all going to reinforce our biases. Then we wouldn't have to have all the commotion about it, if that were the case. And I suspect the vast majority of parents under that set of circumstances would make very sensible choices as to what schools ought to be like.
It seems that we've gone from education, we've lost learning, and we are now educating our children.
Exactly. See, everybody thinks those words are synonymous. God, they aren't even close to synonymous. Education begins in our world at 6 or 5. Learning begins at birth. And by the time we get around to educating them, the war's over. They've had their learning. So I propose that parents ought to have the opportunity to stay home with their children until the children are 6. And they ought to introduce them to all the beautiful things, all the things they love, all the lovely poetry they loved, all the books they loved, all the paintings they loved. And what a nice world it would be if that were the case. And I think it's possible. See, that's what's happening, really. The parents who are aware are doing it. $14,000 that mom's not making because she isn't working. As Nancy Todd Cohen, whoever she may be, bless her, says, but I'm with my child where I want to be. And they are not necessarily mutually exclusive, even at 6, even at 4. Yes, I'm for letting children be what kids want to be. Kids would rather learn than do anything else in the world. You know, the idea of a 3-year-old as a mindless little thing who loves nothing better than to play patty cake is idiotic. So, when we invent a myth, I think that's what most people think. If you say, what's a 3-year-old? You say, well, he's a fun-loving little thing who would love to play patty cake. And when we invent such nonsense as that, we always invent proof for it. And then we prove it. We give him his choice between solitary confinement in the playpen or patty cake, and he picks patty cake, and we say, see, he loves patty cake. Remember when the American diplomats were handcuffed and blindfolded in Iran? I'll bet if you had said to them, we'd rather play patty cake, they'd all have said yes. Kids given an opportunity will always pick the highest level of learning because it requires more adult involvement, and that's what they want because they think they're in training to be grown-ups. So,
thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's a joy to be allowed to go on and on and on. I'm sure you can pick out little spots in the thing that are worth repeating.
Thank you, sir.